This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey there, this is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Best bits from the Business Breakfast on Tuesday, April the 2nd. Thanks so much indeed for downloading the episode where we spoke about the economy in some detail today. Not just the UAE economy, but some of the specific Emirates economies and further afield, looking at the Chinese economy as well. Big focus on the Abu Dhabi economy, though. Why? Because latest numbers with regards to GDP and growth were out from both Abu Dhabi, but also the UAE Central Bank. So we got some thoughts on that from our friends at Emirates NBD. Stephen Anderson, the partner, Middle East strategy leader at PwC Middle East, was also kind enough to join us live in studio. Why? Because their latest Market Watch report, their economy Market Watch report, was out today. It spoke of a robust nature, a resilience here in the region that was impacting a number of economies across the Middle East region. So I got all the latest from Stephen on that. Talking all things, well, the team from CAFU were in, which was nice. Why? Because, well, we've seen the fuel price increase. So that was one of the issues that we wanted to talk to them about, whether there would be an impact on the cost to fill your car by CAFU or otherwise. But also the issue of if you're living in apartments, how do you get your car filled up? If you've got basement parking, if you've got underground parking, etc., can the vans get down there? That seems to be an issue that has been addressed. A couple of solutions from CAFU, some interesting ones as well. Ella El-Houni was live in studio. Talking of solutions, what about the solution of charging your electric car if you are an apartment owner or renter? If you're living in an apartment block, then it becomes increasingly difficult to get access to or install an EV charger. So what can be done about that? The team at Shahin, represented by Philip Heumann, joined us live in studio to discuss this one. Philip's the CTO, the Chief Technology Officer at Shahin. Again, came up with some suggestions, some alternatives, some solutions to what is an increasing issue here for electric car owners. That's all right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast Podcast.
On a numbers-tastic morning, we have got Abu Dhabi economy numbers for 2023 that are out, and we've got some projections about what might happen in 2024 for the country as a whole. That has come courtesy of the UAE Central Bank. Not just one, but two experts on these this morning. Tom is going to be discussing various figures very shortly with Stephen Anderson of PwC.
Yeah, he's going to be joining us in just a few moments' time. Why? The PwC Middle East Economy Watch is out. I suppose if you're looking for one word, you can look at these reports, can't you? And you can see that there's plenty to sort of digest. But if you're looking for one word to sum it up, I reckon it's robust. That seems to be the big word. So suggesting that the economy here in the region remains robust. Don't want to give too much away. We'll let Stephen do exactly that. So we'll pick through some of their latest findings as we look ahead into the rest of 2024 with the evidence that they have garnered, and give you an idea of that. So if you've got any questions for PwC, then get them into us now. Stephen will be joining us shortly.
He is just one of two that's looking at all the numbers. And in fact, as you've said there, they've put together their own report on that. Dan Richards is our other expert this morning, senior economist from Emirates NBD, having a look at the Abu Dhabi economy first. 3.1% was the growth rate for GDP for Abu Dhabi for 2023. Dan's been putting that in context for us.
This growth was really driven by the non-oil sector, which expanded by 9.1%, offset by a somewhat weaker performance from the oil sector. And while the growth figure for oil GDP was not provided by a press release, oil production in the UAE was broadly flat in 2023 compared to that in 2022. So looking at the figures, that 9.2% growth rate is obviously a really strong performance and compares very well to what we've seen on the global front. It's even stronger than that in India, which has been one of the strongest performing major economies from a growth standpoint just recently. But it should also be said that even looking at the headline 3.1% growth, that also stands up well globally, with the US having expanded by a smaller 2.5% last year and the Eurozone just 0.5%.
Not that we're competitive. Right, he mentioned the non-oil sector there, up just over 9%. What is driving that?
So what's been driving that strong non-oil growth? Well, it's been pretty broad-based, which I think is testament to the ongoing diversification in the Abu Dhabi economy as investment is made into developing other sectors to help buttress growth when we have ups and downs in the oil market. Notable growth sectors last year included construction, which was up 13.1% in 2023, transportation and storage activity, which is up 17.1%, and financial and insurance activities, which expanded 25.5%.
And that non-oil sector, now more than 50% of GDP. We asked Dan how significant that was in terms of not just diversification, but also decarbonisation as well.
According to a press release, the non-oil economy was at 53% of GDP last year. And the non-oil sectors are undoubtedly becoming more important in driving growth and employment in Abu Dhabi. Certainly in terms of real GDP, the share of the non-oil sector has expanded over recent decades, from 4.1% in 2005 to around 50% over recent years. It is worth noting, though, that oil production curbs have been in play in the UAE, and if production is ramped up once more next year, the non-oil share of GDP could fall back once more.
All right. So that's one set of numbers we're looking at this morning. The other is the central bank predictions for UAE growth this year and next. Rich, do you want to remind us of those numbers?
Yes. So just over 3%, rising to 5% in 2025. So it's a decent projection. This is for the entire country from the UAE Central Bank.
Yeah. And this is what Dan says when we asked him the question. How do those numbers line up with Emirates NBD's own house views?
The UAE Central Bank has revised down its growth forecast for 2024 from 5.7% previously to 4.2%. Over 2025, the forecast is for 5.2% growth. Now, both of these projections are somewhat more bullish than our own forecast. So this year, we forecast 3.3% growth and 4.0% growth next year. But by and large, the expectation is that growth will hold up well despite the global challenges, especially in the non-oil sector. A key determinant will be for how long oil production curbs are extended and if oil production picks up markedly in the second half of the year, in which case then there would be upside risk to our outlook.
And go Dan Richards, economist from Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Two business headlines for us this morning, both focusing on the economy. Abu Dhabi economy growing just over 3%. Also, those latest numbers from the US Central Bank forecasting the country's GDP to grow by 4% and a bit as well this year. So what you really need is you need an expert to come and explain what is going on with the economy, not just here in the UAE, but the region as a whole. And as if by magic, we've got one. Because despite a few challenges out there, yeah, we know the oil cuts are weighing a little bit. Geopolitical turbulence certainly weighing a lot on the region at the moment. But we have just got the latest results from the PwC Middle East Economy Watch. It's released today, in fact, and we'll tell you shortly how you can get your hands on it. To talk through what's going on with the regional economy, I'm joined by partner, Middle East strategy leader at PwC Middle East, Stephen Anderson, back in the studio with us. Stephen, always good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, morning, Tom.
So I always look at these reports, and I suppose it's just because I'm naturally lazy. And I look for throughout the reports, and I go, is there one word to sum it up? And I've got a couple of R's, and correct me if I'm wrong. Resilient and robust. Would that be fair?
Perfect. You summed it up pretty much perfectly, Tom. My job's done, I think. You're absolutely right.
Let's talk cycling.
That's easy. Robust is definitely the right word for it. I guess at the highest level, and it's nice that we agreed with the central bank. So we said UAE will grow this year around 4%, about 3.7% across the region, and 4% in Saudi Arabia.
One of the reasons, we've talked there about the oil cuts, and that's something that you've focused on. We know that OPEC Plus have confirmed their production cuts moving forward as well. The age-old adage is that if oil is high, then things are good here in the region as well. How's that going to weigh on the economy as a whole?
So it's a pretty uncertain in terms of oil demand globally. So there's a bit of a difference between what OPEC are saying and what the International Energy Agency are saying in terms of what we think the future demand would be. Oil cuts have been extended through Q2. Possibility it could be extended further into the year. I guess that adds a bit of uncertainty. So the UAE is currently producing about a third below capacity, and Saudi's producing about a quarter below capacity. Now that's weighing on their economy. So oil has just gone up, as Brandy just said, off the back of what's happened in Damascus. But with oil price at around about $80, which is where it's been trading, then that will actually be a deficit in Saudi Arabia this year, given the investments that are happening. So that will weigh on the economy there. From a UAE perspective, we're in probably stronger shape. There's a surplus, and you certainly see that in Oman as well.
How often do we sit here and we talk about, you know, the energy prices, the oil prices, gas prices, etc., which of course contribute to the economies here? But as we've seen in recent years, there's been no shortage of initiatives by the governments to invest into the non-oil sector. I don't want to say it's starting to pay dividends, because it's been paying dividends for many, many years, but certainly that area is growing, isn't it?
No, it's racing ahead. Mm. It's certainly racing ahead. So the big transformation themes continue. I think I say this every time I come in. The region's digitising, decarbonising, localising, privatising, and modernising, and that's paying dividends. We're going to see very strong non-oil growth. We're predicting sort of 3.9% to 4% next year. PMI data is very strong as well. We're way above the 50 mark, which is this kind of break even, if you like, for confidence, both in the UAE and Saudi, slightly off in Qatar and in Kuwait. And then I guess the other big news in the region, we've kind of tamed inflation. Mm. Sometimes doesn't feel like it when you're out spending your dirhams, but certainly we've seen transport costs coming down. We are seeing rents ticking up. But generally speaking, inflation is hovering around the 2% mark. And again, that gives us increasing confidence as we look forward.
Another thing that's lingering is, of course, disruption in the Red Sea at the moment. We've had no shortage of logistical, maritime and other experts in talking about the impact that's having on global trade, not just trade here in the region. How's that weighing on the economies across the region?
So globally, you know, about 15% of global trade, about $1 trillion, passes through the Red Sea every year. And obviously that's now being diverted around Africa, adding a couple of weeks at least to how long it takes trade to move around and into the region. So that's obviously going to weigh on costs for the region. What we're also seeing is a little bit more discussion around what are the alternatives. So there's a couple of alternative trade routes that have been discussed. There's one launched at the G20 last year, the India, Middle East, Europe Economic Corridor, which would basically be a rail connection up through Saudi Arabia, then across into Europe. And also the Iraq Development Road, which would take trade, I guess, up the top of the Gulf, just getting my geography going right in my brain, up through Basra, up the Euphrates and up into Europe that way. So both of those are being looked at. Frankly, we'll need a resolution to obviously the things that are happening, the tragic events that are happening in Gaza. Mm. I think would need to be resolved before we see real movement in that regard.
One thing that remains a stalwart at the moment, and I know that how many times have you and I and all the team here spoken about sustainability, and again, it's good to see that we're still talking about sustainability. It is a fixture now in any companies and any industries' plans moving forward. But how's that sort of weighing on economies at the moment, especially when it comes to things like financing?
So I think a bit like the non-oil economy, this is a booming area in green finance. I think in particular, what's coming off COP28 and the UAE consensus, you know, there's the big announcement of the $30 billion Altera fund, which would crowd in $250 billion of financing. And we're seeing that now manifesting in the region. So green financing last year in terms of green bonds and Sukuks was doubled, so it was about $24 billion. Of issuance. We saw people like Commercial Bank, Al Rajhi, ENBD, you saw SEC, you saw some of the sovereigns, so PIF and Mubadala, all issuing last year. We saw the amazing close of the NEOM $8 billion green hydrogen plant, so that was a bit of a landmark. We've seen similar things in Oman. And then the green finance, if you like, the frameworks are now being established. There's probably a little bit more work to do. We think there's around about $168 billion that needs to be unlocked to fund the green transition here in the UAE. And there's also quite a lot of talk out there from the Saudis that there may be a sovereign issuance of green bonds following up the amazing stuff that the PIF have done in that regard.
And I always weigh on you as our sort of regional correspondent. I think you and your team do the most air miles than anyone here in the region as well. So therefore have a good finger on the pulse of different economies around. I mean, is that sort of feeding into foreign investment at the moment? We know there's population growth here, but are we seeing an increase in foreign investment in the region?
We are. We've certainly seen a lot more interest. I think particularly if you look at, just take one example would be the IPO market. I mean, this is the centre of the world from an IPO perspective. It's a complete outlier in terms of the pace we've seen there. And that's certainly attracting a lot of interested foreign capital. I think we're also starting to see as projects move beyond strategy into implementation, then there is a need more to crowd in more foreign investment into many of the larger, say, giga projects in Saudi and many of the projects here.
The Middle East Economy Watch from PwC is out at the moment. How do people get their hands on it? How do they find out the latest?
You can follow me on LinkedIn. Click on that. That's an easy one. That's a cheap LinkedIn.
Get the followers, mate. That's what it's all about.
Get the followers up. Or you can find it on our website. It's probably the easiest way.
We've got 30 seconds. I'm going to use every 30 of them if I can. Just in a word or two, do you expect to see that resilience, that robustness to continue throughout the year?
I do. I think we'll continue to see that robustness kicking in. I think we are seeing some pressure on budgets. Mm. So what I'd expect to see is, yes, we'll continue to grow, but there'll probably be a little bit more in terms of prioritisation, optimisation, and a real focus on ensuring we're delivering value.
Good on you, Stephen. Good to see you as always. Thanks so much indeed for joining us. Stephen Anderson, partner, Middle East strategy leader, PwC Middle East.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where we are all about the apartment dweller this morning. Those of us living in flats, apartments, units, call them what you will, are indeed the majority. And it's dominating the off-plan sector at the moment. So we went down a bit of a rabbit hole yesterday on fuel price day, wondering how apartment dwellers use the fuel ferry at home. So we thought we'd just ask. Ala Al-Huni is the Chief Business Officer of CAFU, and he's in the studio with us this morning. Morning, Ala.
Good morning, and Ramadan Mubarak. Happy Easter to everyone. Pleasure to be here.
It is lovely to see you again. So we wanted to know straight from you, what can and can't you do when it comes to filling a tank in an apartment building?
So it's a great question, and I'm an apartment dweller myself, very, very happily living in an apartment here in Marina. There are several things that we have done today and several more that we're working on right now today. We have areas that we could come and fill up, and it's usually downstairs of the apartment buildings. I use that service myself. And we have another service that we call spot fueling, and that is if you spot a CAFU truck anywhere, you're able to just pull up right by them and ask them to fill you up. And that's one way that we're serving them. What we're working on is we have secured a U.S. patent for a vapor emission recovery system where 100% of the vapors are recovered. And that would allow us to be able to go into underground. We're working with the regulators now to see how we can make a model that works for them and works for us to deliver within the apartment buildings themselves. And secondly, is we're working on connectivity. So connecting to your vehicle and being able to communicate with your vehicle directly and know exactly when that vehicle needs the fueling and be able to do so. I think as many people know, vehicles are parked almost 94% of the time. So finding that right moment of time to come and fuel it.
Okay, there's a lot there. Let's break it down. For the apartment buildings themselves, I take it there are laws.
Yes, of course. And we operate within safety regulations. So we want to make sure that if we do provide in a building, we do it in a safe way.
So at the moment, you're only allowed in the parking buildings of apartment blocks on the ground floor?
Outside, yes.
Outside?
Not indoors. Not indoors.
Not indoors at all?
Yes, exactly.
What, when you say you're working with the authorities on the vapor release, tell me more about that.
So we have designed and secured a patent in the US that allows 100% of the vapors to be recovered within the CAFU trucks themselves. Hence, there would be no vapor emissions inside, indoors, or anywhere from our CAFU trucks. So now we're working with the authorities to allow for regulations, or work with them to allow for the regulations, to allow us to go indoors.
What kind of time frame do you think we're talking?
That's really not up to us. We're working very closely, and fingers crossed, we should be seeing it soon.
We've got an awful lot more apartment buildings on the drawing boards at the moment. It's the majority of off-plan sales. Are you in conversations with developers about more outdoor areas outside of apartment blocks for filling up? Do they talk to you?
Yes, we actually have a team dedicated to the relationship with the communities themselves. And we work very closely with the communities, not just for fueling, but for all our services. We understand that our customers live in these, and we work with the community developers to allow access in a safe way to our pilots into the premises. One of the areas that we are talking to them about is about fueling, particularly in the apartment buildings.
Okay. What does the spread of Dubai developments mean for your fleet in general and how it operates? Because you're just covering a larger and larger area in terms of where people live.
Absolutely. And we use AI routing algorithms that help predictively us understand where demand is coming from. And those algorithms have helped us understand how we design isochrones and geofencing on the areas that we're going to cover each truck. And what happens is it's really linked to the communities themselves. The AI has figured out that people live in communities, and our trucks should be allocated to areas with ease of access to these communities.
Are you having to get more as the city spreads?
Yes. So we have not stopped scaling and growing, and we continuously do so in the city in and of itself. And then within the city, as demand increases, as more and more people are aware of our service, and as the city grows.
You mentioned the tech there in which you would monitor when I needed petrol and what, just do it for me?
Absolutely. So we have several use cases of connecting to vehicles, and we've had probably tens of thousands of transactions today that have come through connected orders. One example of this is with the car sharing platforms. We're already connected to them. And the second that the fuel reaches a specific threshold, and orders automatically generated onto our systems, and we'd be able to go unlock the vehicle or the fuel cap and fill up that vehicle while you are at the comfort of your home.
Okay, so how can you roll that out to more private users?
So we're working with the OEMs themselves, so with all the major brands, to see how we could connect to the vehicle through access with them and by customers giving us authorization to do so. First thing we wanted to do is learn how to do so, and that's why we did it with the car sharing platforms. We're confident now that we can, and we're working very closely with the OEMs.
You guys actually emailed me yesterday to tell me that fuel prices had gone up. Thank you very much. Do you see a spike in people filling up around the fuel price change? What happens?
Absolutely. So our busiest day of the month is usually month end if fuel prices do go up. That's where we hit our all-time highs. The entire teams are all several days in ahead preparing for the end of the month. And we get a significant amount of orders that same day, because people obviously want to slip their orders in before the cutoff and before prices go up.
Right. So after it's announced, but before the change.
Exactly.
What are you seeing with new users in general at the moment, Ala, and what can we take from that population-wise?
So we do sense that Dubai is always growing and always scaling, and we do get a significant amount of new users. The pockets of population, I think, as you said, we're seeing many from apartment buildings coming to us, and I think that probably a natural thing is when people come to Dubai, they automatically go to apartments first before they move on to the villa communities and so on. So we have seen increased demand in these areas in particular. And we're just seeing it all over Dubai, to be honest, in all the different regions, areas, and new areas coming up, where we're continuously getting orders and growing into those areas.
Okay, well, let's quantify ever so slightly. When you say that last day of the month, fuel price day, is your busiest day, what kind of percentage bump on a normal day are you seeing?
I would say we're probably about 30% above what our normal days are on that specific day. That's orders fulfilled. And then traffic into our app is significantly more.
Alla, thank you so much for joining us this morning, having a chat to us, not just about Fuel Price Day, but about what you guys are doing to make it easier for those of us in apartment blocks to fill up as well. Speaking this morning to Alla Alhuni, he's the Chief Business Officer of CAFU. Thank you for your time.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast,
where we are thinking about the apartment dweller this morning. Dwellers, we are the majority, and new towers also dominating the off-plan sector at the moment. So one of the things that we got a bit interested in yesterday, on the back of the rise in petrol prices, was what provisions are being made for them to both fuel up and charge up. Very pleased to be joined now by Philip Heumann, who is Chief Technology Officer at the electric mobility company and the charging company Shaheen. Philip, it's lovely to meet you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Brooklyn.
So what do you guys do? What can you do for apartment dwellers in the way of e-vehicle charging?
Great. All right. Well, thank you for the question and inviting us to the show. Apartment charging has been, you know, really a key question when it comes to the e-mobility sector. Because obviously you can't just install your own charging station like you could do in your villa. So this is where it kind of differs between apartment and villa. As a villa owner, you could, you know, get an electrician in, hook up your charger to your distribution box, and there you go.
I'm going to stop you there. As someone who's just fallen in love with a baby blue Xiaomi e-car, can I not, if I've bought the apartment and therefore the parking space is mine, can I not bring someone in to hook it up? Is there rules?
In most cases, you won't be able to do that. That has to do with you would need to get an NOC from your company, the management company that is in charge of the property. And in many cases, they would refrain from giving that to individuals. That has to do with there's often only a little bit of spare power available in the building. And then hooking up those chargers to the distribution box for each individual would, A, become a technical nightmare, but also an administrative nightmare when it comes to actually metering those utility charges. So the approach that we're seeing now when it comes to the apartment buildings is that developers, but also homeowner associations, are looking to provide shared facilities and amenities to the residents in their community that can be used in a shared manner, in a shared parking space, like visitor parking, for example.
And what are we generally seeing in terms of density for that, apartment units to chargers?
Really, really hard to say at the moment. We can really see that in the last year, the conversation has just ramped up. I mean, in the last year, we've seen that, you know, more than 30,000 cars, EVs are now on the roads in the UAE. And half of that has been added in the last year. And since, yeah, the last year, that conversation was really ramped up. There's only a few residential communities that do offer EV charging for the residents. But roughly speaking, for a big development, you may have two chargers available for, yeah, maybe 100 units.
Is that changing? Off-plan sales, apartments dominating what's on the drawing board. What kind of conversations are you having?
Yeah, it's definitely on the agenda of the developers, forward-looking to promote this sustainable lifestyle. But also the homeowner associations are looking to retrofit their units and developments to, yeah, keep the attractiveness high and keep those EV drivers happy. So a lot of work is underway. And we can see a big uptake in our service offering.
For the new developments, are you getting asked for more charges for apartments than you were before, or is it roughly the same?
Yes is a simple answer, a bit extended. We can see that in future developments, a lot more power provision is being given. So even if they're not installing 10 chargers, they may have power to add more charges in the future.
What's the biggest problem with just putting 20 in a row? What's the issue?
So for one, we have the power constraints. In a certain plot of land, you have a power provision from the local distribution companies. You can't go above that, or it would be very costly to upgrade that. So you got to stay in the realm of that. And, you know, one EV charger is equivalent to 10 apartment buildings at apartment units. right?
In power usage.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a lot of power demand that is out there that is required to power those chargers. So you wouldn't oversize your power system for EV chargers. That's the main constraint there.
Are, again, the new developments putting more power in to deal with this, though?
Yeah, there is a clear trend to that. We can also see that when it comes to the building code, communities or municipalities like Abu Dhabi municipality or also Dubai municipality, they're encouraging the inclusion of EV charging infrastructure. And with that also comes the provision of power. So when we go out to new developments or are in discussion for future developments, we can see there's a lot more power provisions already in mind there.
40 seconds left with you. How much of it comes down to who pays for that power if I'm charging my car?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. So we can see it's a free service currently with the uptake of EVs that needs to be paid also to kind of recoup that investment that is being done by the different parties.
Is that one of the reasons developers not so keen on retrofitting it at the moment, that they're going to get the power bill as well?
It depends. I think regulation there will also come out to encourage that. We can see that in Abu Dhabi, so a clear investment horizon there. There the willingness to invest is high.
Philip Heumann is the Chief Technology Officer at the Electric Mobility Company, which also does e-charges, as you've probably guessed. Shaheen, thank you very much for joining us on the show this morning.
Thank you so much.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.